Theme we feel for the church for the whole year, and we've been exploring what that means in different ways. And this is Psalm 139, which is the psalm that I chose to reflect on. And different people have chosen different psalms to think about and to learn from and explore. The psalms are interesting in a way that they don't always lend themselves to a typical sermon. I'm not sure whether this will be a typical sermon or not, but they are songs, they are prayers, they are poems. And you can really ruin a good poem by analysing it too much, can't you? So I hope I don't do that with Psalm 139 this morning. It's an amazing hymn of praise to the God who knows absolutely everything about us. Have you ever stopped and thought, God knows everything about me? That's what this psalm really focuses on. It's profound, it's poetic. And it's a reflection, I think, really, on the whole mystery of our existence, of being here, and of God being here as well. The psalm begins like this. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. And the psalm writer goes on to say, you discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. The poet sees themselves as a person who is known completely by a personal God. A person is a person because they relate to others. That's what makes us persons. And God relates to his creation and to us, especially in a personal way. God knows when we go to bed and get up. He knows what we're going to say before we say it and what lies behind what we say before we speak, which is something to think about if you end up, you're the kind of person that opens your mouth and says things that you haven't really thought about. But anyway, this knowledge of us that God has goes right to the depths, it seems to me, of what it means to be alive, of what it means to have personality, to have what philosophers call consciousness as human beings. In fact, this song goes right to the heart of what it means to be a human being. More about that a bit later on. The psalm writer then wonders if there's any way of getting away from God. And I've often reflected on this, that perhaps it's because actually to be known so completely, it is actually quite uncomfortable when you stop and think about it. If God knows us so completely, is there not a bit of you that thinks, "Oh, where can I get away then?" Not even your nearest and dearest knows everything about you. And in fact, it's often been said that we don't know everything about ourselves. We certainly don't. And some of us come to times in our lives where we need to explore that more deeply. And just what is going on inside me? What makes me do what I do and say what I say and feel the way I do? But God knows already. God knows everything about us. And the psalm writer says, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you were there. If I make my bed in the depths, you were there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, which is the east, or settle on the far side of the sea, which is in the west, he would have been thinking about the other end of the Mediterranean. Even there, your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me. Even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. Wherever we go, up, down, east, west, day, night, God is there too. When we talk about God, I wonder what we mean. I wonder what you mean when you talk about God. And I wonder what the people that we talk to about God think we mean when we talk about God. It was interesting listening to a little point of view on Radio 4 as I was driving in this morning, and the person that was speaking was caricaturing God as the old man in the sky. an image which is very firm in our culture because it's the way in which people used to think about the Greek gods. But it's not a very biblical picture of God at all. It persists, and if you've you'll know the image of God with white hair and flowing white beard. I'm getting there, but not quite there yet. Creating Adam, a painting by Michelangelo on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and there is God with his finger and Adam with his finger, this perfectly formed human being reaching back. But that picture of God as the old man in the sky does persist, not only in children's minds and in the minds of people who don't believe in God, but perhaps in ours as well, in the way that we kind of relate to him sometimes. Listen to these words from the New Testament. This is the Apostle Paul preaching in the Greek city of Athens in Acts chapter 17. He said, God is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. In him we live and move and have our being. Speaking of Jesus, Paul writes in Colossians chapter 1 that he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Remember that phrase as we go on and think a bit more about the universe in a minute. In him, all things hold together. 1 Timothy chapter 6, we hear these words. God alone is immortal and lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see. And Hebrews 12, quoting the Old Testament, says, God is a consuming fire. Now you take all those words and just begin to reflect on them and you realize God is far more mysterious and not at all like the proverbial old man in the sky. And he is not up there somewhere. He is everywhere. And everything which exists does so in him. That's not the same as saying that everything is God, but there is nowhere that God is not. Which is mind-boggling. At least it boggles my mind. And it's even more mind-boggling when you think about the enormity and also the intricacy of the universe. Astronomers currently reckon that the edge of the universe is roughly, I say roughly, 90 billion trillion miles away. Whatever that means. Apparently our solar system fills less than a trillionth of the available space. And it's moving at 558,000 miles an hour, our solar system. It's part of the Milky Way, that galaxy of stars that we look out on a clear night. And they reckon it takes our solar system 200 to 250 million years to complete its circuit within that galaxy. And there are a lot more galaxies than just the Milky Way. Our Earth, did you know this, moves around the sun at roughly 66,000 miles an hour. And it's rotating at 1,000 miles an hour if you measure it at the equator. Okay, so if you were to go to the equator, the Earth is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour. It's apparently a bit less up here. It's only about 600 miles an hour. So if you woke up this morning and felt that your head was spinning, that's because it is. But that's the big picture, and I find even more fascinating what happens when you think about going smaller. By the way, I'm not a scientist, if you haven't already realised that. I just get this stuff and think, wow, that's amazing. But scientists really began, or goes back really further to the ancient Greeks. They had this concept of the smallest possible component of what is in existence. And they called it the atom. And they conceived of the atom as the smallest basic element from which everything else is formed. And philosophers and scientists continued to explore this idea until in the 19th century, the atom was actually discovered. There are about 1 million atoms. If you lined them up side by side, they'd be about the thickness of a human hair. 1 million atoms. A single grain of sand contains 22 quintillion atoms. That's 22 with 18 zeros after it. That's one grain of sand. An atom compared with a golf ball is about the same size as a golf ball compared with the Earth. But we now know that atoms are actually not the smallest basic element. They're made of smaller parts. Protons, neutrons, and electrons. You might have heard of those. Yeah, even I'd heard of those. Protons, neutrons, and electrons. We're familiar with those words. But scientists now reckon there are about 150 subatomic particles. So not just neutrons and protons, the ones I'd heard of. There's 150 others, including this one that they've been doing all the experimenting with in CERN in Switzerland with this, what do they call it again? Hadron Collider, looking for the Higgs boson particle. Even more weird is what some of these particles actually do, and this is where it gets really weird. Electrons disappear in one place and then appear in another place without apparently travelling the distance between the two. Get that. I can't get that. That doesn't make any sense. Particles vanish and then they appear somewhere else. It's what's called a quantum leap, if you've heard that expression. And this really is new science. The whole idea of quantum physics is changing a lot of the ways in which we have been traditionally taught to think in a very mechanistic way about the way that the universe is made. Particles are not static, they're constantly moving. And an example, if you were to put an electron into the Olympic Games, it could do 4 miles in a second, 47,000 times. 4 miles, 47,000 times in 1 second. That's how fast an electron moves. They reckon that atoms are almost entirely empty space, 99.9% empty space. And if you took out all the empty space in all the atoms in the universe, the whole universe would be the size of a sugar cube. Is that incredible? And all this is happening so fast that it seems to us that it's static, that it's physical. You're sat on a chair and it feels fairly secure, hopefully, this morning. But in fact, it's a relationship of energy that is making something that we can sit on. The writer of Psalm 139 doesn't know the science, but he does know the God who is the creator of all things and wonders about his place within this creation and about his life in relation to God. He goes on to reflect that God's knowledge of us must extend beyond the limits of our earthly lives. So verse 13, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Talking there firstly about who we are deep within ourselves, the whole person if you like, but also the physical body. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Verses 13 and 14 are often thought of when a baby is conceived and develops in the womb. It's one of the passages that lead many Christians to believe that life begins at conception. I had a conversation just the other day with a lady who, when she was expecting her daughter, she was told that it was very likely that there was an abnormality and the child might well be born with disabilities. She and her husband decided to go ahead, and the little baby girl was born perfect and is now grown up. And they're very thankful to God. But we do ask questions when we face verses like this, don't we? At least I do. That same lady who was talking to me told me she'd had 10 miscarriages. And I spoke to someone else the following day. I was visiting one of our patients from Primrose who was dying at home. And one of our carers from Primrose, who provided the service at home, one of the carers there was there. And she said, I went to a funeral yesterday. It was the funeral of her grandson, who was delivered having died in the womb at 20 weeks. These wonderful words point to a truth about God's knowledge of us, but it is poetic and we need to be wise and sensitive in how we use these words. But they still express the wonder of God knowing all about us, including those children that don't breathe their first breath. Woven together in the depths of the earth. It talks on the one hand about the womb, but talks also about being woven together in the depths of the earth. It's a poetic way of expressing the fact that we are made of earthly stuff. If you go back to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, the picture there is of God creating Adam, the first human, from the soil, from the earth, and breathing life into him. A bit like the potter working with the clay. The words are often used at funerals. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, recognizing that we come from the earth. And modern science would back that up, of course, revealing that we are in fact made of the same stuff as the rest of the universe. We're actually made, each one of us, from trillions of atoms, all of which were once part of other things. When you think about it, they have to have been. Atoms form molecules, which form cells, which form different systems in our bodies, the nervous system, the immune system, the digestive system, even when you get hiccups, the respiratory system. And all of that is joined together to make you, you. I came across these things as well. You lose, I don't know if this applies to all of us here this morning, but you lose between 50 and 150 strands of hair a day. And you shed 10 billion flakes of skin a day. Every 28 days you get completely new skin. And every 9 years, your entire body is renewed. That's a heck of a lot of cells, isn't it? Every 9 years, your entire body is renewed. All that dust on top of the wardrobe at home, that's me. But in the middle of all this change and all those atomic particles doing their thing, I remain me and you remain you. Yet there is more to you than all those bits put together. I think that's behind that verse that we just read about you created my inmost being. It's a gruesome thought, but if we were to take you apart atom by atom, we could never find the person who is you. You are more than the sum of all your parts. For me, that's a very profound thought which helps me understand how God works in this world and how God works in our lives. When I was thinking about this, I remembered a scene from Only Fools and Horses. Some of you will know that, Del Boy and all the rest of it. And it's a scene where they're sat in the pub, Del Boy and Rodney and their mates, and Trigger, who is the road sweeper and not terribly bright, is telling them that he's won an award for having the longest serving broom in the council service. And he's been given this award for having this long-serving broom. And he tells Del Boy and Rodney and the others, "This old broom has had 17 new heads and 14 new handles in its time." And they kind of sit there thinking, until somebody finally says, "So how can it be the same broom then?" At which point he holds up a photograph and says, "Here's a picture of it. What more proof do you need?" Actually, we laugh at it because it seems funny, but actually that's just what it is. There is a pattern that is me and all these other things that are part of God's creation, and yet that is the reality rather than the physical part of it. Because I am constantly being renewed and changed, and yet I'm still me. And I will still be me when life in this world comes to an end, and you will still be you. The psalm teaches us that there is no room here for the notion that God is only interested in the unseen, what we often call the spiritual things. Although actually this modern science that people are talking about is actually blowing apart the distinction between the physical and the spiritual in ways that couldn't have been conceived years ago. And some of the arguments against the existence of God are actually very old-fashioned. I was talking to the abbot of Mucknall Abbey a couple of years ago, and he said they had a new monk there, a young man, who was an astrophysicist, a huge intellect, and this young man is exploring his vocation and becoming a monk at Mucknall Abbey and has in fact done that. And one of the things he said was he had absolutely no problem believing in miracles because of his understanding of the way things work at a subatomic level. God is doing it. Not a big problem to him in that sense, because he didn't distinguish between the physical and the spiritual in the way that we've been taught to do through the way we've been educated. So anyway, more to think about. The other part of this which really touched me is that it means that even this body is not hidden from God. God doesn't just know what we're thinking, feeling, and so on. God also knows about your physicality. He cares about what we're made of. He cares about what we do with our bodies. And he cares about the pain they suffer. And the difficulties that we face when bits of us don't work as well as they used to. Which a number of us appreciate, don't we? Fearfully and wonderfully made and wonderfully loved. The overarching message of Psalm 139 is that there's nowhere we can go that will take us beyond God's ability to know us and to embrace us. The psalm isn't meant to frighten us or make us feel uncomfortable. It's meant to reassure us about this wonderful, mysterious God in whom all things exist, loves each one of us. And the psalmist was confident of that. That wherever he went, God was there. And that even death wasn't going to change that. Even there, your hand will guide me. God is there. When our minds are confused and our words come out all wrong. Even there, when we wander off and we do things that we're ashamed of or get lost in life. Even there, when everything seems dark and we feel overwhelmed. Even there, when our bodies are weak and racked with pain. Even there, in the valley of the shadow of death. Even there, you are with me, Lord. And so he turns to praise, verse 17. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God, how vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. He wonders at creation, and I see in this an encouragement to go on exploring and seeking to understand the wonder of God's creation in all its complexity. Then there's an abrupt change of tone in verse 19. If only you would slay the wicked, O God, away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. These verses are often left out when this psalm is read in church. And in fact, there are some settings of the psalm, whether to music or for responsive reading, which leave out these verses because we don't like them very much. They're not nice, are they? He rages, the psalmist, at injustice and the destruction of what God has made. Perhaps thinking particularly of human beings made in the image of God. And we rage, don't we, at some of the atrocities that happen in the world and that have happened in even this past week. At the destruction and the hatred and the violence that we see around us in the world. The Bible never glosses over these things. And the Psalms express how we feel, even if those feelings shouldn't always lead us to take action according to them. Remembering, of course, that Jesus told us to love our enemies rather than pray that God would strike them down. But we pray for justice and that in time God will put all things right. And the Psalm concludes on a quieter note. I wonder if perhaps the writer, for all his righteous indignation, actually realises that his own thoughts may not be so pure and his own actions not always good. And so he prays, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting." His response to the searching gaze of God is an openness to being searched and to being tested for quality. The word anxious there doesn't mean worried. It means anxious in the sense of trying to understand all these things about God and about creation and God's knowledge of me and the troubles of the world and why people do bad things and why bad things happen to good people and so on. And he's not escaping from those things. He's actually open to growing and learning. He's vulnerable and open to God so that there will be nothing that gets in the way of following where the Lord leads him. And we believe as Christians that God knows us completely. But we know more than that psalmist did because we believe that God, the source of all life, the one in whom we live and move and have our being, the ultimate reality, the one whose very nature the Bible tells us is love, has come among us and shared our humanity. God knows firsthand what it's like to be a human being like you and like me, with all the possibilities and all the frustrations and the pains, even and through death itself, so that he can take each one of us by the hand and lead us through death into a life everlasting, an eternal life in which we will be like Jesus. So one question remains. What will you do in response to this? What will I do with the life that God has given to me? Let's reflect on that.